University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Eleanor Smeal, President of the National Organization for Women, speaking on the status of the women's movement today. Originally from Erie, Pennsylvania, she first served as president of NOW from 1977 to 1982 and was elected for the second time in 1985. She is a Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Duke University and holds a Master's of Arts degree from the University of Florida.
Nebraska drew international and national attention this week with the race between two women for governor. It seems quite fitting today that our speaker today at Forum herself is a political activist. Eleanor Smeal is the current president of the National Organization for Women. She has a long history with the world's largest feminist organization, serving as president of Pennsylvania NOW, elected to the National Board of Directors, and serving as chair. In 1977, she served as president until 1982. Again, in 1985, she was reelected to president for a second term. What makes a homemaker from Pittsburgh move into the national spotlight? Like all of us who are feminists, she was pushed by outrage. At 10 years of age, she realized that some girls were not able to date her brother because her father was an immigrant from Italy. While at Duke University in North Carolina, she discovered blacks were not allowed to attend the university. As a Phi Beta Kappa, she organized a move to integrate the campus, which did happen years later. Continuing on to graduate school, she was advised not to become a lawyer. Women in 1961 did not practice in the courtroom. She earned an MA instead in political science and public administration from the University of Florida. She married, and while a homemaker concerned with the lack of daycare services available for her two children, she became involved in the women's movement. She joined NOW and has continued to work on national and state level areas involving policies affecting women, including Social Security, equity for women, affirmative action, pay equity, insurance reform, women's health concerns, and problems of midlife women. Ellie's biggest campaign during her first presidency was the ratification of the ERA. As we know, that did not happen, but it will. She intends to do exactly what women's working for women rights did 70 years ago, and that is to keep hammering away. During this term as president, NOW will tackle the most controversial women's issues head on, and she will speak about these this morning. Her leadership has been acknowledged in a variety of publications. In 1983, the World Almanac chose her as the fourth most influential woman in the United States. Time magazine named her as one of 50 faces for America's future, and she was featured as the most influential Washington lobbyist in U.S. News and World Report. Ms. Smeal is truly a woman who is continuing to forge the way for women's rights. She will speak to us today not only on issues that affect women, but issues that affect humankind. May we welcome Eleanor Smeal, president of NOW.
Thank you very much. It's good to do a summary right now on where we're going in the women's movement right after the November 4th election, because I always see when I was young, I saw every September right after Labor Day as a marking point. You're going to school. I'm sure a lot of you still see that. But now, as a political leader, I see every election as a marking point and to regroup afterwards. Actually, this election was a very successful one for the advancement of women in politics and for our issues. Just to give you some statistics, I'm sure you've had a lot on the women's governor here. We have the first woman Republican governor elected, obviously, in this state, Kay Orr. We had the first woman United States senator on the Democratic side elected, Barbara Mikulski in Maryland. In both of those races, there were women, obviously, as their opponents, the first time in history that two women were running against each other for U.S. Senate and governor. But that really doesn't tell the story, because these still are the firsts, and they are not statistically significant. Unusual thing events happen. What are the statistical trends? At the congressional level, we're staying the same. We've been a little less than 5% of the American Congress since about the 40s. There is no statistical difference. Barbara Mikulski won and Paula Hawkins lost, and so we still have two senators, or 2% of the United States Senate. We still are approximately the exact same number of members of the House, about 4% of the House. Now, what does that mean? Well, fortunately, you can't tell a trend from that, but I can see trends in other figures that are much more encouraging and tell you where we're going in the future. At the state level, in 1984, 18 women ran for statewide positions. That means governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, attorney general, treasurer, those types of positions on a statewide ballot. In 1986, 52 ran, over four times the number. Already in 1952, we had more people, of course, elected at the statewide level than women by a significant increase than we did in 1984, just because of the numbers. More than half of the women ran, so in 1986, more women were elected to state office than even ran in 1984. You're seeing remarkable increases, 50 and 100% increases. And that is not even as good as the next stage. And what was the next thing? At the state legislative level, 1,800 women ran, largest number in history. And, of course, more people than history won. And you're seeing a constant increase in the state legislative area. Of course, it's the state legislatures who then run to statewide offices, who run to governors, United States senators, and so it's increasing and increasing. At the cabinet level, that's the people that service the governors and secretaries and attorney generals, all that are appointed, now not elected, we are doing extremely well, much better than we were. Obviously, I'm never happy until it's parity, but there is increases. The top 10 governors in the United States, we have over 30% of their cabinets now females. 10 years ago, we were token numbers like 4%. Now there's still governors that are in the 4% range, but that's now the bottom. And the top, the highest is Louisiana, which has 50-50. The only governor in the country that has 50-50 in his cabinet. Well, an unusual, too, a southern governor that has it. Actually, the trends of where this is happening is northeast and west. More and more women are in politics. To give you an illustration of how numbers go, I'll give you a local level number, which can show you how the multiplier starts having effect once you get beyond the first years of growth. In 1985, 14% of the state legislators were female. In 1970, about 72, 73, it was 3%, or we tripled in that period of time. But still, it's 14%. And so you say, will it double beyond that? A good barometer is what's happened at school boards. In the early 70s, at school boards, elected school boards in the United States at the local level, we were about 14%. Of the school boards, the same as where we are in state legislatures today. Today, for school boards, we're about 40%, almost parity in the composition of numbers. I think when you look at the local level, the state level, and the national level, there's only one conclusion to be made. More and more and more women are running, more are winning, and indeed, by the turn of the century, we will be near parity in many of the local and state areas. It is an historical event that's happening. KOR is one symbol of that event, but it is indeed at all levels happening. There is change afoot, and I think it affects what is decided in the decision in the bodies. In other words, are we just changing male bodies with female bodies? Is there a change, a coming in content? I believe there is. I'll give you an example on school boards. A study has done recently to show that school boards, when they were dominated almost 100% by men, primarily dealt with the subject of the business contracts, the brick and mortar, the arrangements of insurance, the buildings, the financial arrangements. Today, school boards are much more interested in what happens in the classroom. Why? Because the women who are being elected frequently come from an education background, have been teachers, indeed are mothers who are interested in what happens to their class, to their children, and who are more involved with the content. And so now you have a little more balanced decision making. The school boards are not only interested in the brick and mortars and business, which is being brought to their attention from the men on the board who come from that background, they're also having the women bring in the educational content, actually a more balanced look at the schools and at the subject matter. Why is this change in content? Because we are still living primarily in a sex-segregated society in which women are conditioned to want to deal with nurturing, nursing, taking care of the elderly, hospital care, health care, the human services. And men are have been conditioned to be more interested in the business, military services. I think that as we integrate, it can only help but more balanced decision making, because it will bring all the variety of perspectives that are actually in human society to the forefront of decision making. The status of the women's movement is healthy today. We are, in fact, a popular movement. You know, every place I go, I'm told by the people who've organized the speech, look out, this is a conservative place. This was no exception. I just want you to know that you are totally in keeping with every kind of community you can think of. I go to Long Island and they tell me, look out, this is really conservative here. I go to Manhattan, New York City, look out, there's a conservative trend here. I go to Boston and they talk to me about cardinal law and how really conservative it is here now. I go to Los Angeles and I'm told, after all, this is Ronald Reagan's area. I go to the southeast, north, and west, and I'm told this is really a conservative place. And you have got to worry. After a while, I have to tell you, I'm disappointed if they don't tell me this. I don't know if I feel at home. One of my favorite stories on these sort of, you know, attitudinal things is that I went to Bucknell, which is a small university in the east of my own state, Pennsylvania. I was raised in a little town called Erie, Pennsylvania, on the lake, 150,000, not too much different than Lincoln, really. And I was I raised my children in Pittsburgh. My husband is from a little town called Altoona, Pennsylvania, right where the railroad, Pennsylvania Railroad's big switching area was. I know this state. But I went to Bucknell, and they met me and said, you got to worry, Allie, this is really a conservative place. I said, oh, God, here we go again. But anyway, I said, don't worry, I do know Pennsylvania, I'm not. So anyway, oh, they were so worried. I was debating Phyllis Schlafly. And this was 1984, not 100 years ago, and it was the year Reagan was going to get reelected, but I could care less. On this issue, I know that we are popular, but they kept worrying. And we had a reception before, and there were about, in these receptions, it's usually the people who arrange the thing. And I looked at this reception. There's about 40 young people standing around me telling me not to worry. There were good people here that were for women's rights, but I would probably be disappointed by the debate, et cetera, et cetera. And then I looked over at Mrs. Schlafly, and there was nobody standing around her. I guess they figured she didn't have to worry. I don't know, but I knew one thing. This room was not quite balanced. So I said, you notice this room is not quite balanced. Oh, that's right, that's right. But we're the ones who arranged the speech. And I said, well, why'd you have her? Well, we had to, because the administration is really conservative. Anyway, So I started to ask these folks, the young people, I said, well, what are you all going to do? And one was going to be a doctor. They're mostly women, young women students. Another was going to be a lawyer. A third was going to be an engineer and a BA and an MBA and an accountant and an architect. And I said, is there no ordinary, just, you know, not professional jobs here? Oh, no, no. I said, you're real conservative people. I said, is anybody going to be a housewife here? Total silence. This is a really conservative institution. They are all females. Isn't one of you going to be a housewife? No. I said, well, is anybody here engaged? They said, what? I said, you know, that's a custom. You have a solid diamond ring on your left finger. It's the one on the index finger. Have any of you seen one lately? Well, one young woman knew a junior in one dorm that had one. I said, this is indeed a conservative institution. When I went to college at Duke University, in addition to being segregated by race, I never will forget the segregation by race. I didn't know that. They didn't say it in the brochure. But anyway, now what did I know from Erie, Pennsylvania about Duke? They told me it was one of the top 20, and I always wanted to go to the top, so what the heck. Anyway, my next shock was that everybody, the women students, were intent upon getting married by the time they were seniors. And I'll never forget they called it something, I think faculty, senior advisor to freshmen. They had a name, I always forget it, doesn't matter. She was mine. She was a senior in the dorm. And she became 21. This is not a million years ago. I got to keep reminding people the hair is gray, but it is really like 1958. She was 21. We had a little party for her, and she starts crying. It becomes like a wake. I couldn't get over this. I'm 18. What is she crying about? 21? It's not that bad. I kept saying, you know, it's not this bad, Molly. Why are you so upset? Well, she wasn't engaged. This was a big deal. Big, 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 when you were not engaged or married by your junior or senior year, not 100 years ago, just my generation. Today, it is, well, as I said, at Bucknell, I don't know about you, you can do an inventory. Somebody knew one person. I said, do you worry about this? And I say this now, by the way, to students all over the United States. They say, no. I said, why not? Well, because they're going to do this and they're going to do that. Of course they're going to get married, but it's going to be a little later. And besides, they're going to see the world. And times have changed, and they're changing. We don't like to admit that, but they're changing, and they've changed. For women, they've changed phenomenally. And we can hardly keep up with it in our brain. But they've changed. And they're changing. What's changed? Most of us now work outside the home and we're employed. When I was being raised, most women were housewives. Today, most women are employed. Tomorrow, it won't be most. It will be almost everybody. Why? The site of employment has changed. I mean, let's face it. My mother had a Ringer washing machine. I was trying to describe one to some young people yesterday, trying to describe a Ringer washing machine to someone who's never seen one. It seems weird. I'm sure there are students here who have never heard of a Ringer washing machine. My mother washed with a Ringer washing machine. My other oldest brother, she used a scrub board. She would be alive today, would be 87. It took her one day to do the wash, one day to do the ironing. She had it down pat. It took 22 minutes to do a white shirt. She did 20 of them because I had three brothers and a father who was an insurance person, and they used white shirts, and she can't do this. I mean, you multiply out the time, and she was fast. She had it down to a science. That science isn't necessary because, obviously, we have permapress. Things have changed. The reason I mention that is we pretend that nothing has changed, that we can have yesterday's answers for tomorrow, and everything has changed and is going to keep changing, because the one thing we know about the condition to be human is nothing stays the same. We don't like to accept it, but it's reality, And so often in our romanticizing about the past, it is the woman we want to live in the past to keep us stable, while everybody else rushes pell-mell into the future. Well, we can't stay put, and we're not doing it. In fact, it's no fun to live in a romanticization of the 19th century, as indeed the world goes to the 21st. And I think that's really the essence of what the women's movement is about, to help ease the change for half the population and to make it fairer and more just. I was talking at the YWCA luncheon about, which I spoke at yesterday here in Lincoln, about various issues and how they change and how indeed we as women and men must deal with them. I used the family planning issue because indeed it is a hot issue in this state, and I don't like cold issues. I find them rather boring, and I don't like to bore anybody. But more importantly, I think it is important to hit issues head on so people can think about something that maybe is controversial in their own brain. There's no sense talking about things we all agree about. We all learn when we talk about things we don't agree about. This issue, incidentally, is an issue I personally faced years and years ago. I was raised a Roman Catholic. I married a Roman Catholic. We didn't even know very much. I have to say I was raised a Victorian. In my household, you spelled it. It was called S-E-X. I didn't know the real word was really sex for a long time. I'm not exaggerating. My mother was a Victorian. She kissed her husband once before they married. Wasn't allowed to date him by himself. They had to be a chaperone. I was raised in a very traditional way. And then I learned on my second child that I had a blood disease called Mediterranean anemia. And I knew that, indeed, I was going to have to make a decision about birth control a lot faster. I made that decision because, funny thing about it, I like to live. And I like to live as normally as possible and didn't want to risk infancy. And after spending nearly a year in bed after my second child, I decided enough is enough. I wasn't alone in this, and I don't think any of us are. It takes two to tangle. And my husband decided enough is enough first. I have to say the truth, because it scared the heck out of him. Difficult pregnancies are not something one likes to remember, but they happen to a lot of people. And so we made a very practical decision, one in which most people do at various times, because we, most of us that are human, cannot have all the children that we biologically could probably have. Biologically, 16, 18 children would not be unusual. For our human condition in the 20th century to be the 21st, it is most unusual, not very practical, and can't be sustained by most of us. And so we choose to limit our size of our families. For my religion faith system, this is against the rule. Birth control is forbidden as much as abortion. But like most people who are raised in my faith system, we decided to bail out. And so as many Catholics, as Protestants, as Jews, and as non-believers in our country, 75% of us practice birth control, despite what the hierarchy tells us. It's the same, you know, on abortion. We can all be academic about it, talk about when life begins, but when push comes to shove, an awful lot of us opt for it. We did it before it was legal, and we're now doing it when it's legal. The statistics don't lie. We estimate that of women who are of their childbearing ages and could be pregnant, over half now have had an abortion. That is reality. We don't make up these figures. In fact, and they are believed to be conservative, low estimates, because not all doctors need to report it. Abortions don't need to be reported in our society, and only those who want to report do report. And of those who report, over 1.5 million are reported yearly. It's a fact. That is reality. The reason I mention reality is because I think we like to deny it. We like to invent. We like to pretend, and especially in this issue called sex, we pretend a lot. Well, anyway, as a result, we have a dichotomy. We have social reality, and we have face systems that say other things. And then we have controversies in the political arena. I think the controversy is alive in the political arena because of those statistics that I said before. 14% of the state legislatures are female. 5% of the Congress people are female. I believe if it was 50-50, we would be on to another subject because it would be over with. I'll never forget in the United States Senate, a man named John East, who now is deceased, was a senator. I happen to know John very well because I went to graduate school with him. But he was a radical right-winger and a right-to-lifer. He held these hearings on When Life Begins, in which the entire panel was male. Entire panel. And almost every witness was male. And the audience was almost 100% female. And it wasn't organized because we decided, most of the feminist groups, to forget it, who cared. We knew the conclusion, the hearings were biased, and we did not really encourage people to come. But anyway, the audience was overwhelmingly female because the staffs of the United States Congress are overwhelmingly female, and they came to hear it. In the middle of the hearings, some women jumped up and said they couldn't stand it anymore. And they weren't organized, which had me crazed. I couldn't get over that people non-organized would spontaneously jump. If you know anything about organizing, people almost do nothing without being organized to do it. I don't understand it. If you heard something happen, you remember the Montgomery bus strike, which Rosa Parks refuses to sit in the back of the bus, right? You ever hear that? And that's the beginning of Martin Luther King. And I always thought it was Rosa Parks, who was a cleaning lady, and she got tired of going to the row of the back of the bus, and by God, she sat in front of the bus. Forget that one. She was the secretary of the NAACP in Montgomery. Oh, forget. Oh, little. When I learned that, it made me trust again my organizing principles. You need to really get fortified when you're going to make such a statement. If you're really tired, you sat in the back of the bus. But if you're going to make a social statement, you had to have been gunned up to do it. But anyway, but was there a problem? There was a problem. That's why it's stimulated the tremendous desegregation fights of the South of the 60s. But anyway, when you look at social issues, you look for what happens. And you think to yourself, why did those women jump up? There was no organizing. I knew this. I was confident of it. What did they say? They were thrown out, by the way. They're hysterical, almost. Because you would be an hysterical, too, if you were there, and you were just an ordinary human being, and a female, and a young one. Because they wouldn't use the word woman. They were discussing When Life Began, and they were talking about putting a tape into a tape recorder. You get it? They were talking about when the music began. They were talking about cows and frogs. And all kinds of species, and all kinds of mechanical things, but not called women and men, and never the word woman. And so people would start jumping, the woman jumped up and said, will you please say it? There's a woman involved. I can't take this anymore. It is okay if you use our name. It is not a tape recorder, what woman said. It's a woman, it's me. I got it right. Anyway, those hearings concluded that women didn't have rights. Well, they can conclude all they want. But if you face that, you have a right. And in fact, you make the decisions with those who you trust and love. So there is this fiction of a political debate, and then there's reality. Most people using birth control, most people thinking that if indeed they were raped, they had incest, they had a troubled marriage, they had their divorce, they were poor, all kinds of conditions, ill health, life dependent on it. Somewhere along the line, they probably do it. Or they did it. But the debate goes on. Well, this last election, the debate was on the ballot in four states. Boston, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Arkansas, and Oregon. There were anti-abortion referendums on the ballot in all four states. the pro-choice side won. Is this unusual? What does this mean? No, it isn't unusual. And 22 times it's been on the state ballot, and all but one time we have won. And it does not matter the amount of money. It's very interesting. Money talks in elections a lot. On this issue, it doesn't seem to have an overwhelming impact. In Massachusetts, the cardinal was against us, campaigned against us. The pulpit campaigned against us. We were outspent, and we still won by 15 points. In Rhode Island, the bishop campaigned against us. We were outspent. It was outrageous, really. Didn't matter. We won almost 2-1. We won over 2-1. There's a reality. People have made up their mind. They want themselves to be able to make this decision, not some church hierarchy and not the government. We want these decisions to be personal, local, human decisions. And I believe that that won't change. I believe that if they do outlaw it, and it could be outlawed, not only abortion, but also the IUD and the pill. And what happened is this. We now have a 5-4 majority on the Supreme Court for keeping abortion legal. One more appointment by Ronald Reagan, it will be 5-4 to outlaw abortion. If abortion is outlawed at the national level, or, let's put it this way, they strike down the right to privacy, which outlawed or declared unconstitutional laws that declared abortion illegal, what would happen is it would then become a state-by-state decision. We know that we would lose in state legislatures that are highly influenced by established structures. We would lose in the Massachusetts legislature, highly influenced by the power of the church. We would lose in the Rhode Island state legislature. And so it would be outlawed there. What would happen then? Does that affect of birth control? Yes. Because the IUD is an abortifacient, it would essentially outlaw the IUD. And the pill, the low estrogen pill, is also an abortifacient, and it would probably be banned in the same places. Without the right to privacy, we could not reverse it at the Supreme Court level, and so we would have some states that would make it legal, some would make it illegal. And what would happen then is that poor women and women who could not travel to other places would be the most victimized. But also what would happen? The black market, the illegal market, the crime market would benefit. Abortions now cost $225. We estimate they will go to $4,000. Incidentally, when they were illegal in 1972, that was about the price of them was about $1,000 to $2,000. There's no question they will go to $4,000. The pill, which is attainable, although expensive, price will skyrocket. The IUD, incidentally, is already now being sold on the underground market because a lot of companies have taken it off the market and its price has skyrocketed. What it will be doing is the same thing that happened with the prohibition of liquor. Crime will enter, prices will go up. Who will be victimized? The poor, the lower classes who cannot afford it. What will happen eventually? It will be made legal. Why? Because people are going to make this decision, whatever the price. I happen to believe, though, that this issue is very important for another reason. But I believe the women's movement in the United States is important for another reason. What we do here affects people worldwide. The debate on the position of women in the United States affects the position of women everywhere. America is looked to as a role model because we're rich. Because people want to emulate what is rich and successful. If women have more opportunity here, it will spread worldwide, and is, by the way, spreading worldwide. If we go backwards, that also will spread worldwide. And right now, we're going backwards. And let's go into where we're going backwards. Title IX was passed in 1972, and it said, you could not have federal funding in any educational institution that practiced such sex discrimination. In 1984, this was taken to court, and they said, you're right. You cannot have sex discrimination in any institution of higher learning or an education that receives federal funds. And then they added a but. Only that part of the institution that actually receives the federal funds that we can prove is the site of where the funds comes in cannot discriminate. the rest of the institution can. In other words, if the student aid program receives federal funds, that student aid program cannot discriminate, but the rest of the institution, if it doesn't, can. 96% of this educational guarantee has been struck down. Incidentally, that was Ronald Reagan's interpretation. That was the Reagan administration's interpretation. Prior to this, from 72 to 86, 84, it was the entire institution covered. We will see a decrease in scholarship programs for women in sports. We already are seeing it. In 1984, 75% of the athletes at the Olympics that were females that are on the United States team were there because of Title IX scholarships. By 1988, far fewer will be there because Title IX scholarships are disappearing for women. That's only one area. Administrators in higher education are telling me women's programs of a wide variety are losing funding. And so we are going backwards. We're going backwards in other areas. We're going backwards in the enforcement of affirmative action and employment. Why? Because EEOC has been essentially taking a line that they will no longer enforce the law industry-wide. They will only take case by case, woman by woman. The result? Enforcement is essentially stopped, and protections are going, and therefore more exploitation and more discrimination is existing. That's the facts. Those are the realities. We are going backwards. Now, are we going backwards because there is not support for women's rights? Baloney. We've never had such support. A Newsweek poll, and certainly no one could call that a feminist tract. In 1986, this year, March edition, asked the question of American women, a huge poll, by the way. It was not a little poll done by Gallup. Very small error error rate in the poll. Do you consider yourself a feminist? 57% of the public said yes. Of young people, ages 18 to 24, it was over 70%. Asked, do you consider yourself a supporter of anti-ERA or Phyllis Schlafly? 4% said yes. Isn't that incredible? Asked if, do you believe the women's movement has helped your life? 71% of all women said yes. Of women 18 to 24, 88. Those are powerful statistics. Then why did we just lose the ERA in Vermont? We lost again. In Maine in 1984, we lost the ballot question on ERA 2-1. In Vermont in 1986, we lost by about a percentage point, very close. What was the difference in 84 and 86? Not much on public opinion. It's just that we now are learning more about how to deal with the lies, the scare tactics, and the negative campaigning of our opposition. In 1984, when they said on the ERA campaign in Maine, ERA AIDS connection? We didn't know how to handle it, I'll tell you the truth. Can you imagine that, having to deal with this? ERA AIDS connection, says the Phyllis Schlafly Eagle Forum brochure. If you're confused what the connection is, so are most people. But it's scary, especially when you constantly are told ERA will lead to gay rights, and then the next minute you're talked about AIDS, and then you think, oh my God, what is this world coming to? And everybody's worried anyway what the world's coming to, because everybody worries about it. I mean, people are scared of tomorrow, especially older people are scared of tomorrow. And so there's a constant use of big lie, big fear, big scare, big scare. There is no connection, of course. And then our side says, well, should we talk about it? Should we move back from it? And some of us have argued, and I've argued very strenuously, you don't move back an inch, you face it head on. You want to talk about AIDS? I'll talk about AIDS. Okay, I'll become an expert in AIDS. Let's see what in the world this subject's about. You know, the opposition, the fundamentalist ministers will tell you it's a divine plague. It's God telling you about homosexuality. That's what it's about. And I say, well, okay, it's a buying plague. Interesting, divine plague. I wonder what God's saying. Male homosexuals are in the high-risk group. Lesbians have no reported cases. Could it be that God is saying lesbians are the chosen people? Think about it. The opposition says the ERA will lead to rampant abortion. Rampant abortion. And the opposition says that what now is and what the ERA movement is, it's lesbians running around demanding their rights. And so I got one sentence to deal with them. You can shorten their whole argument to one sentence. The ERA is being pushed by a bunch of lesbians running around spreading AIDS as they demand abortions. No problem. But I can laugh now. When I first heard these imbecile arguments, I could hardly deal with them. Because I will not back off human frailty and human beings and human suffering. The gay baiting of this day is reminiscent of the anti-Semitic Jew baiting of the Nazi era. And let there be no mistake about it. It's to take our mind off of the real problems as we scapegoat people who we can malign comfortably. And in Germany, you can malign a Jew and get away with it. And then the Germans didn't have to face the real problems of the post-World I society of Germany. They didn't have to face the problems of the industrialization problems of Germany. They didn't have to face the unemployment. They didn't have to face the modern problems. They had all the answers. It was those Jews. The final solution. And here in this day, we don't have to face the problems of a post-industrial society with massive unemployment in large parts of our economy. We don't have to face, and incidentally, real unemployment is very high. Don't believe those statistics of 7%. It's more like 15. And don't believe that there's not problems on race in our society. Teenage blacks are at 50% unemployment, 54% in our nation's capital, and unemployment among blacks is 25% in our country. Don't believe there's not economic problems when 350,000 houses are on the market in Houston, Texas, in the largest recession that state has ever had in recent times. Don't believe there's no economic problems when you have a farm economy that is destructive and dangerously injured. We have real problems, and those problems are not because of homosexuality in our society. And AIDS is not a virus of homosexuals. AIDS is a virus of the human species. We're all going to get it. It's a virus that is spreading. In 5 years, we'll be both heterosexual, homosexuals, males and females. It is being exploited by those who say they have all the answers as they spread bigotry and hate and divide people against people. And so I say I'm glad that they're throwing everything they can at the feminist movement. Because it means we're succeeding, folks. When they got a lie to win, it means they can't deal with the arguments anymore. They can't make a realistic argument of why women should be underpaid. They can't make a realistic argument why insurance should discriminate on the basis of sex. They can't make a realistic argument, really, on abortion. They must use moral scare tactics. Because they know and we know that family planning is a necessity in the world of overpopulation. We're winning, folks. Lies and scares are the last tactics used by defeat. That is reality, in my opinion. And I think we should recognize it for that. We're going into a new world, whether anybody likes it or not. and our country must face the progress of tomorrow. Incidentally, the AIDS issue is very serious. I am glad that Coop, as the Attorney General, as Surgeon General, has finally admitted it and is finally saying that we must teach sex education in the third grade. Something the conservatives kept saying we don't need and is bad. Finally, a right-wing leader is saying it. We can't hide anymore. Sex should never have been taught in the streets. We should never have allowed our youngsters to be exploited by this, as we are with the use of it on television. And we should never have destroyed progressive ideas by blaming them for something that has always been with us in our society for time immemorial. The reason I've gotten very heavy is because I think the days are heavy. But I also think there is a new day always. I'm very proud that we came within one point of winning in Vermont. I think that the defeat of the ERA there is the last defeat. We know how to deal with big negative tactics now. I think negative campaigns are running their course. I think America is going to start dealing with the future again. I don't think we need to be scared of it. The future is bright, especially if you look with it at hope and you look with it as unity. Teaching that people are bad, that we can't unite, that there are enemies among us, is negative teaching. Teaching that people can deal with the problems of today and go on as one, that there shouldn't be discrimination and injustice, but there should be justice and hope and equality, ultimately wins. Falwell can say that he went to Africa to find a few good blacks that like apartheid. He can call it the Liberty Federation. But you know and I know that ending apartheid and freeing blacks is justice. So you can say black is white, but only so long. And eventually they'll be free, and so will women, not only here but worldwide. Thank you very much.
Today's speaker on University Forum was Eleanor Smeal, president of the National Organization for Women. She spoke on the status of the women's movement today. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.